I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. In today's episode, we'll be discussing mental illness and suicide, and so I want to warn listeners at the outset that some of this content may be distressing.
She sat me down, and she asked that question that I was most terrified of, which was, "Are you sure you want to become a doctor?" And I just froze. After that initial advancement committee meeting, it was my first time I actually really fully contemplated suicide. Because I just did not know where else to go. There was this gut-wrenching pain.
The Physicians Foundation conducts an annual survey of America's physicians, and in 2023, they decided to include medical students and residents in the survey. And according to those results, 25% of medical students know a physician, peer, or colleague that has died by suicide.
On April 26, 2020, Dr. Lorna Breen, an emergency medicine physician at New York Presbyterian Allen Hospital, died by suicide. During those early pandemic months, when so little was known about the virus, Breen had been caring for hundreds of critically ill patients. But in the midst of giving everything she had to her patients and colleagues, something inside of her broke. And when she died, it felt like something broke in our profession too. At a time when so many others were working under extreme fear and uncertainty, I know her struggles resonated with a lot of people. But mental illness among healthcare workers long predated COVID. And in that sense, her suicide proved a tipping point, igniting a wave of activism that culminated in a federal bill called the Dr. Lorna Breen Healthcare Provider Protection Act, which passed the Senate in a unanimous vote and was signed into law by President Biden in March of 2022. The bill, which funds research on physician burnout and mental illness, and also intends to create an infrastructure to support mental health among healthcare workers, is obviously an important step in the right direction. But we also can't just legislate our way to a more forgiving culture. And even as the stigma around certain mental illnesses like depression and anxiety begins to lessen a bit in society at large, in the culture of medicine, mental illness is still often perceived as weakness. Indeed, in the weeks before her suicide, Dr. Breen had texted her sister, quote, "Everyone can tell I can't keep up," unquote. And as her family described in the aftermath of her death, Dr. Breen had feared that seeking help would end her career or cause her to lose her license. Obviously, if it's hard for physicians who already have jobs to seek help when they're struggling, it's harder still for trainees. Trainees are at a more vulnerable point in their careers and at a point when any perceived instability could be viewed as a red flag by future employers or lead to bad evaluations. And at the same time, the stressors that can push those with mental illness over the edge can be more stark for trainees because their lives are, in many ways, harder. Physically harder, financially harder, and sometimes emotionally harder as well. So in an attempt to chip away at this culture that views mental illness as weakness, but to also try to understand in a more granular way what an infrastructure to support trainees with mental illness would actually look like, I have two guests today, Dr. Chris Veal and Shreya Mandaba. Shreya is a medical student at the University of Virginia. She's a founding member and inaugural chair of the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation Medical Student Coalition. So I asked Shreya what motivated her to lead their efforts.
I'd always had a bit of an interest in peer health advocacy, just dating back to my undergraduate years. But I would say it was really during my third year of medical school that I was inspired to do this work. I saw firsthand the challenges faced by myself and my classmates while transitioning to our clerkship years. However, it was really the tragic loss of a medical student in my own community to suicide that I was motivated to become an advocate for medical trainee wellness. And unfortunately, what I experienced is not uncommon. The Physicians Foundation conducts an annual survey of America's physicians, and in 2023, they decided to include medical students and residents in the survey. And according to those results, 25% of medical students know a physician, peer, or colleague that has died by suicide. And the rates of burnout reported among medical students are actually higher than those among residents and physicians, with 7 in 10 medical students reporting feelings of burnout.
Shreya also talked a bit about the main barriers to well-being for medical students.
There are a lot of competing demands on a medical student's time. Obviously, first and foremost, that involves schoolwork, which, the first year or two involves the preclinical curriculum, and then when you transition to clerkships, it's both completing clinical rotations on top of studying for shelf exams. So there's that, but then there's also other things that students are involved in, including research, volunteering, extracurriculars, all of that just on top of sleeping and taking care of yourself. And unfortunately, there's not always a lot of flexibility in the curriculum for time off to do those take care of yourself human things.
Shreya had surveyed many medical students and noted that a lot of them have responsibilities outside of medical school, or they have their own health issues that require greater flexibility. One student's story in particular stayed with her.
So she has a chronic autoimmune illness that she's had for most of her life and been on therapy for years. And given the unpredictable nature of the illness, she had flares during medical school that made it hard for her to adhere to her schedule and the rigid attendance policies set by the medical school administration, which required doctor's notes for any sort of absence due to illness. And so on top of her struggles with chronic illness, she also experienced personal hardships and served in a caretaker role in her family. So her grandmother passed away at the start of medical school. Her father experienced an MI, and she ended up being the primary caretaker for him. And she felt that overall her school was largely not accommodating of both the chronic illness flares and then the additional familial roles that she played. She mentioned that she was denied a request to visit her grandmother the week before she passed when they knew she was at the end of her life. And so I share this to highlight that a lot of medical students, in addition to their role as a medical student, play a lot of different roles outside in their personal life. And there can be a lack of curricular flexibility that prevents them from feeling like they can essentially succeed in all of these different roles.
Finally, I asked Shreya whether mental illness among students and trainees is getting worse.
Unfortunately, I don't think there is a lot of longitudinal data. The survey I've been discussing, the Physicians Foundation survey, this is the first year that medical students were included in that. And there's been a lot of different studies attempting to estimate rates of depression, rates of burnout among medical students, but there's not really a clear way to trend that over time, is my impression. But I do think that leads to another important point, is that I would argue that this sort of information should be tracked and trended over time for patterns. I think another thing that's been highlighted in medical journals and other forums is that right now there's not really any sort of centralized body keeping track of medical trainee suicides, unfortunately. And it's a very, obviously, a difficult issue and not one that a lot of organizations want to take on. But it's kind of hard to adequately describe and characterize a problem without having the data to do so.
To dive more deeply into one trainee's experience with mental illness in medical school, I spoke with Dr. Christopher Veal. Chris is a family medicine resident at Carle Foundation Hospital at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's been a vocal advocate for trainees with mental illness and has written beautifully about his own experiences. I'm going to let Chris tell his own story.
You know, I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. Detroit in its suburbs, I guess. I identify as African American, and both sides of my family descended from slaves. So, there was a very common thread of progress in my family, despite sometimes what life would throw at us. But overall, I would say I had a fairly decent childhood. There was a moment in my life where I had cancer, and so at the time there was a lot of financial difficulty. My family, I didn't have insurance. And so as a result, my parents wanted me to get care, get all the surgery and everything that I needed for that, tumor and to be removed, as well as associated treatment. But the medical bills just crippled my family. And so ultimately that contributed a great deal to the financial strain, and ultimately kind of resulted in us losing our home. I was 12 years old. As a kid, I really did blame myself for, that demise. And, I was really angry at the medical system as a result of that. And so really, I had this resentment that kept building. And really, I mean, if you want to ask kind of at the end of the day, what got me into going to medicine, becoming a doctor, that was it. It was the activist component of it that led me to pursuing this profession.
Chris had mentioned that going into medicine was the biggest gamble you can put yourself through.
You know, there is a perception that you become a doctor and, yeah, it's not easy and you're going to get a lot of debt, but that you eventually finish and you have this marvelous life of helping people. What I didn't expect was that, that passing the MCAT and getting in was just the first major hurdle of many more to come that would all be within medical school, right? Leading up to medical school, I had already, had my struggles with depression. About 6 months before medical school started, my best friend had died by suicide, and it really hit me hard. But that being said, I had already had this kind of low-lying hum of anxiety and depression, and my family, we didn't really necessarily talk about that, when I was growing up, despite it being prevalent, right, in my family and in my community. But the fact of the matter is, when you're raised Black in America, quite frankly, there are more things to be concerned about from a survival standpoint than just discussing your mental health. So it wasn't really, when I would call my grandmother at times of sincere depression, right, could barely get out of bed in the morning, my grandmother, who as of today is 99 years old, she was partially raised by her grandmother, who was a former slave, right? And so her context in me complaining about my depression was met with, oh, child, depression doesn't exist for Black people. You think, Jim Crow is a warm and fuzzy environment? You think slavery is a happy job to have? Depression is just our baseline, right? And so with that context, and with that history, and that understanding that I am part of a long legacy of trauma, but also perseverance, I just figured, well, you know what? They aren't going to want to hear it. I'm not going to get anything from it. Let's just keep pushing through and hope for the best. Unfortunately, you don't know what you don't know. And so when things got really bad and I really didn't know where to go from it, it was, I didn't know what to do.
So in what ways did things get really bad?
University of Vermont is where I went to med school. It's a great place, but it's incredibly white. that being said, yes. I mean, I think by the time I was there, it was actually the whitest state in the country. But I'm sure it's the whitest medical school. I'm sure it would have been a stat too if it was actually quantified. That being said, great education. But I did feel remarkably isolated. I was the only Black man in my class. There were two Black females, and one wound up leaving actually after the first semester. But in a class of 120, I did feel that there was a lot that I was missing, and I felt like I was representing my entire race instead of representing myself, right? And my family also didn't hide that either. They really did kind of say you're here representing all of us. And I take that as a pride of joy, but at the same time, it was pressure, right? So it started with that. After that first semester, there was quite a few of my fellow medical students who were people of color who did not come back. And some of them were my friends. what I was told was that many of those who left were more or less encouraged to leave. And one of the ways they were encouraged to leave by one of the deans was the dean would ask, are you sure you want to be a doctor? On top of that, there was the fact that I came out of the closet, you know, just before coming to med school. You know, my dad's side of the family didn't really particularly take that very well, nor did my father. And so kind of my relationship with my father kind of, I can say now, in hindsight, it was placed on pause. But it really did. It was a big struggle for me. And so I felt like that lack of support, the lack of community, and, struggling with depression that had been untreated, it really contributed. And I wasn't doing well in school. You know, I mean, I tried to push this down as much as possible. But the, that untreated depression, that denial of it contributing, certainly contributed to my performance in school. And so I, tried to keep going, but I felt like there was a target on my back. And I was really trying to do everything I could to avoid that question of, are you sure you want to become a doctor, from being asked upon me.
I asked Chris what trying to keep going looked like for him as he went through the medical school curriculum.
Well, when I was a kid, my mom, when she went back to school, she would always have this quote that she would say. She would say, failure is not an option, which is actually coming from the Apollo 13 quote. But she would use that as a motivating factor for herself to get through school at night, but also for me, because for us when I was a kid, failure meant that we were on the street. Failure meant that we didn't have food. So that mantra kept playing in my head, like, failure is not an option, failure is not an option. I struggled, but I was able to pass. I still was passing my courses. By the time my second year came around, though, basically the dung hit the fan, and failure had to become an option because I failed a class by a single point, nonetheless. It was a huge blow, and it definitely was not what I was expecting, nor what I could really handle at that time. Ultimately, I was put in front of the advancement committee, and, I was at a Congress hearing. I was kind of on one side, and this entire panel of people were on the other side staring at me, and, I didn't want this to be that moment where I was asked to go, right? I wanted to at least, I didn't want to go out without a fight. So I just basically, in the best way possible, said, I acknowledge my deficit here. I'm going to do everything I can to do better. I'm happy to retake, whatever exam, whatever course I need to retake over the winter break. Just let me keep going. And I promise you, things will get better. Now, what better meant was ambiguous. I was not ready to get any mental health help. I was willing to see a tutor, but me being a very independent person, very independent upbringing, wasn't really open to really changing my academic ways. I just thought that the problem was, I didn't work hard enough. I needed to work harder. I needed to stay up later. I needed to get less sleep. I needed to just be better. Ultimately, it didn't work out. I sacrificed my winter break, didn't see my family, studied for that retake on top of preparing for step one. And ultimately, I came back to school, took it again, and I failed it again. just a huge heartbreak. And, because I wasn't prepared for that, and because I had already started to feel this depression worsening, it became a point of no return. After that initial advancement committee meeting, it was my first time I actually really fully contemplated suicide, because I just did not know where else to go. There was this gut-wrenching pain that just took over me. And so I didn't know how to get rid of it. It eventually went away, but I asked myself at that time, if this comes back, what do I do? Well, when I found out that I failed that exam, you know, that feeling came back. I remember being called into that dean's office, and you know, when I was she brought me in, and I was already anxious as I was. I hadn't been made aware that I had failed the second time. And she sat me down, and she asked that question that I was most terrified of, which was, "Are you sure you want to become a doctor?" And I just froze. You know, there was this, I vividly remember that moment. You know, there was this ear-piercing noise that kind of grew within me, kind of like a tinnitus kind of thing. And, you know, I just sat there numb. You know, my heart just sunk, and that pain, that gut-wrenching pain came back. I didn't remember anything else she said after that, but I do remember my just gut-wrenching desire to get out of there. I wound up leaving there and finding myself in a stairwell, one of the enclosed stairwells at our university, and I just dropped down to my knees and just cried.
Before Chris continues, I want to interject that I reached out to the dean for comment, but I didn't receive a response.
Felt like a failure, and I didn't know what else to do. I mean, I felt like, well, I couldn't go home, because if I go home, you know, they're not gonna want me. You know, my father kind of already disowned me. I was hanging on by a thread with my family in terms of them, you know, fully taking me in for who I was, and I didn't even like myself, you know. And so at that point, I thought the only way to get rid of this was ending it. But I didn't want to end it in a way that would bring shame to my family. You know, I really wanted to, you know, I wanted to do this in a way that my mom could move on with. And so, you know, when I recognized that, you know, the school was actually closing that day because it was a terrible snowstorm. This was Vermont, and, you know, beginning of February. So I thought, well, maybe if I drive my car full speed into the traffic light at the corners, at one of the busiest intersections of the campus, you know, my family would assume it was an accident because it was bad weather. I slipped on some ice. And so that would be acceptable. And so I got my things, picked it up, and I walked out to my car. The snow was falling heavily, and, you know, I could barely see in front of my hand. But I got to my car, wiped off all the snow from my car. I remember sitting in my seat, in my car seat, watching the snow accumulate on the windshield. I thought about my godmother, who, well, I started calling my godmother, but she was the mother of my best friend who died by suicide just prior to me starting med school. Something deep in me made me want to call her to just say goodbye. She was not aware of this, but that was basically where my, you know, instincts, that was kind of what was the thing I feel like I needed to do. And, you know, I think one of the reasons was that, you know, her and her husband were one of the most, they were the best people I needed at the time when I was early in med school. They lost her son. I lost my best friend. My parents kind of were not as present in my life at that time, and I needed some guidance. Both her and her husband were both doctors, and they provided me both the professional and the spiritual, emotional relationship that I needed. And so for me, I didn't feel like I could actually go without saying goodbye. So I called her and said, you know, the moment she picked up the phone, she, you know, said, you know, "Chris, what's going on? There's just something off with your voice." I said, "No, Carla, I'm good. Just want to check in. Just want to see how you're doing." You know, I want to just leave it at that. But she was not having it. You know, she just basically said, you know, "There's something going on. What's going on?" Ultimately, I broke down and said what had been happening. I didn't tell her that I was planning to die by suicide, but I did tell her that, you know, I was in a bad place. And I think that she knew that I may have been up to doing something reckless. So she kept me on the phone. And ultimately what she wound up doing was getting me home safely, but also we had a planned commitment to, you know, take a pause from school and go live with her and her husband out in San Diego until I could get to a better place. So that's where kind of things stood. And she saved my life. I mean, really. I called her my godmother because she supported me, but she also saved me. You know, I think she was sent by God. So, yeah, that's that.
Yeah. Given what he'd gone through, I asked, what would a more supportive environment in medical school look like? Chris talked about the importance of screening medical students for depression. And he said medical professionals must stop seeing mental illness as a sign of weakness.
It wasn't that my school didn't have these resources available. I want to make sure it's clear. They did have resources available. I just personally did not feel comfortable accessing them. I felt that if I did access them, you know, it was a sign of weakness, that it was going to negatively affect my perception from, you know, a dean's letter or a, you know, or any kind of advancement or, you know, if I wanted to stay there for residency. You know, there was just a lot of shame. You know, ultimately, it's the biggest thing is just destigmatizing the issue. I mean, as a third-year FAM master resident about to graduate, now, you know, with a signed contract, have my medical license, I'm on my way, I'm fine right now. I can look back and tell you that, you know, there very much was a, you know, I felt that I could not just show my vulnerabilities. I felt as if my depression and my anxiety and the trauma that I carry was a liability. When in reality, it's an asset. All those things that got me to this place where I am, you know, the cancer, the poverty, the loss of my friends, that made me who I was. That made me who I am today. You know, I always say I feel like I am a wounded healer. And I'm very proud of that. Because ultimately, you know, if I hadn't gone through all that, I wouldn't really know how to best help someone who is going through that. Or at least I wouldn't even know, really recognize kind of the impact it has on their life, their private life, the life that I don't see. You know, I only get 15 minutes, 20 minutes with a patient each day. There's no way I can get the full story. But if I know what to ask and I actually am intentional, I can get an idea. Med schools need to learn how to do that as well, right? They don't need to interview every single person at the medical school, but they at least need to try to have some kind of screening tool, to have some kind of resource that will allow folks to not only know, one, it's okay to be to not be okay, that what, and two, that your trauma and that your story is a liability, it's an asset. It's okay to be a wounded healer. It's actually preferred. That's why we got in this profession to begin with. Encourage the fact that people should be proud of where they came from, not ashamed of it.
I want to go back to that moment in the dean's office, because I think, let's just pretend that there are deans listening or those of us who are sitting behind the desk and are meeting with a student who's struggling. And instead of saying, are you sure you want to become a doctor, which is like the most horrible thing to say, what do you think would have helped to have heard? What can we say to people when they come to us at this breaking point? Is there anything that we can say that you think would be helpful when we probably, assuming, you know, don't have a close and warm relationship that you had with your godmother?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is before a dean jumps to a position of this person is a lost cause, they should leave. Ask them what more we can do. You know, what do you need? And if it's okay for the student not to know what they need, right? And because I can guarantee you the student's not going to be forthright with what they need. But allowing them to understand that we are going to do whatever it takes to keep you here. That is what I need to hear. That is not what I heard. But I think it can be as simple as that. The resources will come. Whatever is needed academically, mentally, socially will come. But it is the fact that you can say without hesitation, we are going to do whatever it takes to keep you here. If you want to leave on your own, that's on you. But we will keep you here as long as you want to become a doctor. That is what I need to hear.
I want to thank both Chris and Shreya for their bravery, advocacy, and willingness to come on the show. You're listening to Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum. Our editor is Deborah Molina. Our senior producer is Mary Rose Madden. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. We also get invaluable feedback from our team, Jenny Pittman, Julie Brazelet, Sue Ellen Lee, and Abigail Schuback. We're off next week, but on the next episode of Not Otherwise Specified, we'll be taking a closer look at the relationship between education and well-being as we try to figure out which aspects of our educational environment should be preserved and which have become relics of a past that ought to be left behind.
One of the things that started happening for me was recognizing that the institution will always want more. There will always be another rung. There will always be another star. There will always be someone else that you can benchmark yourself against and find yourself wanting. But that for all of that work, the reward for that starts being more and more meaningless if you don't have the other things in your life that you want.
That's next time on Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Thanks for listening. Until next week.